Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation on this Aloha Friday, September 5th, Hawaii Talks. Today we take you to Molokai, where we hear from residents who are taking part in an off-the-grid program, how solar is helping to reduce energy costs. We take you down to a recycling center, where efforts have been focused on marine debris. Plastics in particular are getting new life in construction materials. But for how long? Federal funding cuts are threatening to send the center out to sea. We met a shopper who's been putting in some sweat equity to save money on food. And what's this about stem cell transplants? We take a closer look at the medical breakthroughs and hear heartwarming stories. Tune to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio, Hawaii Talks. I'm Catherine Cruz. You may be familiar with being off-grid or on-grid, but what's this about a nano-grid? Here to tell us about that is HPR's Catherine Kluwit-Pachtel. Good morning, Catherine.
Good morning.
Yeah, you know, our household was an early adopter for solar, but so much has changed in the last decade. So what's this about a nano-grid?
Yeah, so technology, like you said, is improving so quickly. So just a moment of terminology for folks so that we're all on the same page. So off-grid is when you are not connected to Hawaiian Electric's infrastructure, versus on-grid, which is, you know, you have a meter through Hawaiian Electric and you get your electricity that way. A nano-grid is a small system for an individual home that is off-grid, so not connected to Hawaiian Electric. And it is, in this case, a combination of solar energy stored in batteries. And so many people may have heard microgrid. That's a little bit larger system for more like a neighborhood. So we're talking about nanogrids here, really small systems for a single household. And there are a number of families on Molokai that are off-grid. So they use generators for power. Some of them do have a combination of, you know, sort of more outdated solar systems, like you mentioned. And a few years ago, Molokai, the community here, went through an energy planning process. And so out of that came renewable energy goals and initiatives that were very community-driven and locally initiated. Leilani Chow is project coordinator for Ho'ahu Energy Cooperative Molokai. And they are the lead on this project that put in 14 nanogrids for off-grid families on Molokai. And this really gives them a huge amount of energy independence. They have, you know, they don't have a huge gas bill for their generators. They don't have to just budget every moment of their lives. They can flip on this light switch at night. It's, you know, these little things that so many people take for granted who are on, you know, Hawaiian Electric's grid. But Leilani Chow talks about this nanogrid program logistics and how these 14 participants were selected.
One of the projects that was in our portfolio of 10 projects was individual solutions. So this is like people getting solar for their rooftops connected to the grid and also for those who are off-grid. And Ho'ahu took the lead on developing a solution for our off-grid folks who are usually missed by like the larger energy projects simply because they're not connected to the grid. And so we got funding and technical support from Sandia National Labs and PNNL, which is Pacific Northwest National Labs, which came with help in designing an off-grid system for specific like Molokai lifestyle. And also funding to purchase the equipment, which is another barrier for folks, right? Like these systems that came out of the program were on average about $33,000. And that's with like bulk purchasing and bulk installation and all that. And so that's still a pretty big bill for people to front. And so Ho'ahu and Sandia and whatnot like helped with the financing of it. There were 14 spots available for this current nanogrid program. We opened up applications across the island. I think there were like 50 plus people who applied for it. And the hard part was like selecting who would ultimately get the system. But we went based on, you know, folks who have kupuna in their homes, keiki in their homes, folks who are off-grid, not by choice, but because HECO isn't able to like bring electrical infrastructure to where they live. Folks who have life-saving medical equipment that need electricity on demand 24/7. And then also a little bit based on like people's financial situations.
Yeah, and we should probably acknowledge that, you know, the energy costs, right, the fuel costs on Molokai are much higher than other places across the state.
Absolutely. You know, people that Leilani talked to during this process were spending an average of $500 a month in gas and propane for their generators and for, you know, like to run a propane fridge or stove. And so now with their new nanogrid system, these residents are spending about $140 per month for the next 10 years, kind of like an electric bill, but it's financing for this system. And so after that, they own the system, and they are basing it off of average Molokai household usage of about 250 kilowatt hours for people who want to get the technical information here. And people are finding they have enough energy to run like AC units and you know, larger electric fridges and appliances they couldn't run before. There's also an app to monitor the energy output of the system and their usage. And all of these 14 systems will be installed by the end of October. So some of them already, some families already have them and are enjoying the little luxuries of life. Some of them are still in the process of being installed. They're all being put in by a Molokai Energy installer, HAO Energy LLC, with an all Molokai team. So it's really cool that, you know, it's a really community-based grassroots effort here. Hawaiian homesteader in Ho'olehua, Cheryl Sterner, has lived off-grid for more than 20 years, so they're really used to these sort of daily little struggles. And before their new nanogrid system was installed last week, she had an outdated rooftop solar system with generators as well.
The thing about it was we needed to have the generator anyways, because when we reach periods of rainy weather, you know, sometimes it could go 3 days a week of bad weather, you need a backup. So the inverter that we had a built-in charging system on it. We would just need to plug the inverter cord into the generator and it would automatically kick off the charging system. And that's how we survived. It's really nice now to have all the, I call it luxuries of life, you know, because we don't really need ice. We don't really need a vacuum. They're sweeping and mopping manually. And that's how I lived many years. Because I was like, I don't want to go outside to start a generator just to vacuum up a mess. So for many years, I've just lived very simple life. And now, as I'm older, it's nice. I don't have to work as hard. I think the main thing is our refrigerator. That's the number one thing that we really like, is not having to worry about our refrigeration taking up all the juice, or we were running too many things and because of that our refrigerator can't run it, you know, and we gotta go charge up the system.
Oh, kudos to her. My refrigerator went out, and boy, that was humbug. But oh my gosh, I can imagine that this is just a life changer.
Absolutely. You know, people are just talking about, you know, just being able to charge your cell phone overnight, or, you know, being able to connect to the internet, you know, whenever you want to without charging, you know, plugging in the generator, just these little things. And Ho'olohu has a lot of future projects for larger scale renewable energy solar power for the island as well coming up in the next few years. But you know, Molokai residents use the least amount of energy per capita in the state and almost nationwide, and energy prices are among the highest. So renewable energy is definitely on people's minds, and this is a great program to allow folks to utilize these nanogrid systems.
And then what are the chances for funding for the next go-around?
You know, they hope that because of the high demand that they will be able to do a round two of the program, but, you know, it is federal funding. They're not sure of that. It's through the Energy Storage for Social Equity program. And, you know, it's just a little, you know, iffy whether that will be able to continue.
Okay, but it's not Solar for All, right? Still different.
It's not. Okay. Different program. And, yeah, hopefully it'll be able to do another round and more folks can utilize this nanogrid technology.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Catherine.
Thank you.
That was HPR's Captain Kruitt-Pachtel reporting from Molokai. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. Were you ever on staff at your high school's newspaper or yearbook, and did you excel academically? If so, you might be familiar with the Quill and Scroll, an international honor society formed in 1926 to recognize students' achievement in journalism. For decades, the Honor Society has recognized and encouraged outstanding achievement in journalistic writing, photography, design, and leadership across media platforms like newspapers, yearbooks, and more recently, online publications. Over the past century, the Quill and Scroll has inducted students from over 11,000 schools in all 50 states, the District of Columbia, and 30 nations. But there was one school here in Hawaii that became a charter member of the Honor Society just 2 years after its founding. For today's quiz, we want to know which Hawaiian school became a charter member of Quill and Scroll way back in 1928. If you can hit this one out of the park, call 808-941-3689 if you know the answer. Pick up a reusable HBR tote bag if you're the first one to get it right.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nereit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits that are working to provide affordable housing programs to transition renters into homeowners, such as Hawaiian Community Assets. NereitHawaii.com.
Hawaii's only marine debris recycling center is running at full capacity after opening last summer. It's part of Hawaii Pacific University's Center for Marine Debris Research, and a full-time staff of four is turning plastic trawl nets into building materials, and helping to pave roads and more. The Conversation's Maddie Bender recently stopped by the recycling center on a busy day. She brings us the story.
HPU's Plastic Recycling Research Facility operates out of a nondescript warehouse in Kalihi. When I pull up, volunteers are loading salt-crusted fishing nets into the belly of a shipping container. Music is playing. It feels like a plastic party. I spot Jennifer Lynch, co-director of the center that manages the facility.
And we're about ready to try something new, where we're using the truck to lift this into the container instead of our backs. So it's a first trial, and we'll see how it goes.
Okay, how's it going so far?
This is try number two.
Yeah.
A yellow ratchet strap hangs from the back of a pickup truck. On the other end, volunteers get ready to push a massive tangled ball of marine debris into the shipping container.
Okay, everyone be ready to push the pile in. It's caught on the knot.
A bit of regrouping, and the pickup truck gives it one last pull. Mafalda De Freitas runs the megaplastic program at the warehouse. She congratulates everyone on a job well done.
Well done, guys. Teamwork. Innovation.
So was that a success?
Yeah, that was a success. Some of this is incredibly hard. Incredibly heavy.
And so it requires more than what our small team can handle. And so innovative use of the truck, dragging it in. We have a forklift that we usually power it all up with, because it's just very heavy, like dead weight. And so, yeah, that was awesome. And now we can just plop everything else over the top till they come and replace the roll-off bin.
So this today's nets come from the Papahanaumokuakea Marine Debris Project. Only about 30% of the marine debris received by the facility gets recycled. The rest is loaded up in shipping containers like the one outside. Radius Recycling picks up full bins, shreds the contents, and takes it to H-Power. There, it's incinerated to produce electricity. DeFreitas walks through the life cycle of a piece of marine plastic that ends up at her facility.
So if stage one is when they're taking it out of the environment, stage two is when we receive it and we sort it into the different polymers. Polymers are different types of plastics. This is all trawl nets. It's not nets used in Hawaii. The Hawaii fisheries doesn't use this type of material. It's actually banned around Hawaii. And the longline fisheries uses monofilament longline. And it's not what we receive. That actually, because it's so dense, it sinks in seawater. Whereas trawl nets float. And they make their way around the Pacific Ocean to the North Pacific garbage patch. And then with the trade winds and the way ocean currents, gyres, slowly make their way to the Hawaiian Islands. Okay. So it's all foreign fishing gear, foreign trawl nets, mm-hmm. is what we're recycling here.
And so what determines what goes out there for the bin versus what stays in here to be recycled?
A lot of what we receive is completely mixed, different polymers. So the lines, for example, are made out of different plastics. And so that will go outside to the bin to be incinerated. In here, we just keep the HDPE nets. Try not to keep any other type of plastic. Just because we're still starting up, we're small, we don't have the capacity to sort, for example, mixed nets that are made up of HDPE and another type of plastic. And so what comes inside is just the HDPE. However, there is also some HDPE that ends up getting put in the roll-off bin to get sent to H-Power if it's too dirty, if it has too much biofouling in it. It just makes it a lot harder to have to clean and recycle. And so we pick the easiest, the lowest hanging fruits right now.
Could you describe what's on the ground in front of us right now just to a listener?
Yeah, so in front of us, we have a colorful large pile of trawl nets. The nets are what you imagine a large fishing net to be made up. They've got some of the different thicknesses than others, depending on how deep the fisheries is setting them. And they are made up of this HDPE plastic that we are recycling. We have some really great bright orange ones. Predominantly, they're made out of green netting. If they're used closer to the sea floor, I might be wrong, but my understanding of it is that they're usually darker. Just make it harder for the fish to see, is what I've been told happens. So right here in front of us, we have a huge mix of different colors of fishing nets, of different diameters. And yeah, that we will now be sorting through to take out some of the lines that shouldn't be in there. There's some bits of hard plastic that are just entwined in it that we'll also have to take out. And then we'll put it into super sacks so then we can shred and then proceed to the next stages of the recycling process.
We can talk about each of those steps because I imagine that machine
is
involved. Yeah. It looks like a roller coaster.
It does look like a roller coaster. It is our very large shredder. We share the facility with Eopala, which is the island's e-waste recycler. They are the owner of this warehouse. They got too big for it and moved elsewhere and let us take over their space and very kindly left their shredder that we share with them. And so we use that to shred. It starts all the way over there in the back room with a conveyor belt, and there's a lot of conveyor belts attached together. So that conveyor belt leads up to the main shredder there. So it goes up the top, it drops down. There's some wheels with teeth on it that grind it all down. It then goes into another conveyor belt where it goes up, and you can be there. So if there's something that shouldn't be in there, you can kind of take it out. If there's a bit of hard plastic, if there's a bit of line, you're like, oh, nope, that's snuck in there. And then it drops down the chute at the end into some super sacks. We'll then tie it off and store it until it's ready to be converted into something.
So that is essentially where the life cycle ends for this facility.
For this facility, yes, right now. For this facility, it ends at the shredded stage. We are looking to bring machinery to continue on the other stages to into a final product. Okay. We are collaborating right now with a company in Omaha, Nebraska that makes plastic lumber. We sent them 400 pounds of our shredded nets, and they have made four different recipes. So one for their boards, and so one is using 100% our fishing nets, and then the other one was 75% our fishing nets and 25% their post-consumer waste, so your household products you put for recycling. The third recipe was 50-50, and then the fourth recipe was 80% our fishing nets and 20% hard plastic that we receive from beach cleanups. And all boards have proven really successful. They're really impressed with the results. And so what we want to do now is bring those machines here so that we can make those boards here on island. So we don't have to send all these shredded nets to the mainland and then wait to receive boards back. We can just keep this closed loop circular economy here and produce boards and products in general here on island. But right now, yes, our stage, this warehouse, ends at the shredded net stage.
That was Malfada De Freitas and HBR's Maddie Bender. After the break, we learn about how shifting priorities in federal funding is putting this facility at risk. They've just got 2 months to find a new home. Stay with us.
Support for HBR comes from the Honolulu Board of Water Supply, Ohana, working to protect and manage Oahu's water resources since 1929 for fresh water now and for future generations. BoardofWaterSupply.com.
Hawaii Public Radio is looking for an experienced, community-minded business development professional to join the team. This full-time position is ideal for an individual who thrives on building partnerships and successful sponsorship strategies. Please send your resume and cover letter by September 17. Pay range and more at hawaiipublicradio.org/jobs.
Support for HPR comes from Honolulu Magazine's Haleaina Celebration tomorrow evening at the Royal Hawaiian Hotel, its annual culinary gala celebrating Hawaii chefs. Tickets at hnltix.com.
Let's return to our story about the marine debris recycling facility at HPU. Mafalda De Freitas spoke with the Conversation's Maddie Bender about the short history of the facility and the uncertain road ahead.
So we moved in here in June of 2024. Before this, we had a small, we called the net shed. It was this shell of a warehouse at the Hawaii Pacific University lower campus over on the windward side. We then moved here to this facility in June of 2024. It used to be owned by Eopala. Well, it is owned by Eopala, the island's e-waste recycler who outgrew this and are partnering with us to help us with the business side. How would this work? How does recycling in general work, having access to a shredder as well. So they were very kind to let us move in. And we have really taken over, also outgrown, very rapidly outgrown this facility. Because as you see, every shipment that we bring in, it's a 20 to 40 foot containers worth of material that takes up the entire warehouse that we then have to sort through. Before Eopala was here, this used to be a noodle factory, I think. So if you see like the holes in the pipes on the ceiling, that's how they ventilated the room to dry out the noodles. So it's had many stages, from noodles to e-waste to now marine debris recycling. But it's been a really great stepping stone for us to learn a lot of protocols, how we need to sort, how to deliver, how to receive material, then once we shred it, sending it out. And so learning all the processes of how do we treat this marine debris so that we can recycle it. Unfortunately, because of funding limitations and cuts. We are, our lease here is up at the end of November. We need to find a new home, desperately need to find a new home. Not sure where we will go. We're currently in a sprint to fundraise because the funding for this project for recycling all this marine debris ends in March of 2026.
How long have you known that the lease would be up on this space and you'd have to find a new one?
We've known for a while. Obviously, since we moved in last June, we knew that our lease would end. It actually ends in August, so end of this month. But one of our partners, he is able to take over and let us stay until November. Very kindly has offered to support us that way. We had applied for a NOAA Marine Debris Project funding for $10 million that we felt very confident for. That would help continue all of this effort together with our partners on PMDP, Kauai, Maui, and Big Island. So together with each of those, the funding would have continued us on for the next 4 years, which we unfortunately did not get. And so we learned that we didn't get it about a month ago now. And so, or in fact, about 2 weeks ago. Time is a blur at the moment. And so that has led us into a bigger scramble of, oh, okay, what do we do now? And that's when our partner helps with, okay, well, we can stay until the end of November. And then now we're reaching out to everybody that we know and asking everybody to reach out to their friends and their contacts, even if it's just land space that we can then set up some makeshift construction to keep this going, because we really don't want to see this stop. It's such important work that is happening. And so we're confident that it'll pull through. It's too important for people not to care and not to want to see it continue.
And is it just the space, or is there question over funding for some of the staff positions or like your own position?
Yeah, so it's for everything, not just the space. So all of our team, the entire Center for Marine Debris Research, not just this warehouse, so the lab site that we have as well. So it's all of our staff, and the projects that we have will end in March if we can't secure more funding to keep this important work going. And the microplastic side, which is based over on the Makapu'u campus, they do really important work in terms of monitoring and measuring microplastic quantities, additives, leaching, a lot of things that impact human health as well. And so it's two branches of this problem that we tackle that are super important that we are in need of funding to help support and keep going. Obviously, with small bits of help, we can make do, but funding for everybody's salaries will end in March.
You're talking about this in a very like level-headed way, but this sounds big and scary and existential.
It is definitely big and scary and very sad. I'm a hopeless optimist. I feel too passionate about this to think that others won't feel passionate about this, especially once they come and see the extent of what we receive, the quantities that we receive, the hard work that goes into it. And just to think that all of this, before it was here, it was out in the environment. It was out in the ocean. It was trapping seabirds. It was trapping the monk seals that are now, you know, pupping. And so this has such negative impacts on our planet that how can people not care? And so I'm very positive that somebody will care just as much, even if it's not a tenth of what I care, and will pull through, and that something will happen. Not everybody in the team is as optimistic and level-headed as I am. I try to lead by example, and just if everybody's running around panicking, then nothing will get done. So let's do this one step at a time, one bridge at a time, and it's too important for people not to care. And so I'm confident that even if it's at the 11th hour, something will pull through. It's not over till the fat lady sings. And so I'm going to make sure I gag her
so she doesn't.
Okay, got that visual. That was Mafalda DeFreitas, the Mega Plastics Program Director at the Center for Marine Debris Research at HPU. We've been hearing about the Plastic Recycling Research Facility, the only marine debris recycling center in the state. It will be out of its space come November, and its staff will lose funding in March of next year. And a footnote, HPU is a Hawaii Public Radio underwriter. Time now for another installment of What's in Your Cart? The Conversations D.W. Gibson recently went to Foodland at Ala Moana, where he met Jennifer. She was visiting from Shingle Springs, California. She talked about the creative way she goes about getting healthy food.
I really came in to get some poke. I really prefer poke from Foodland. So just flew in today, so I have a Pavlovian response to get some poke from Foodland. So I got that, some fresh fruit, and I got a couple of drinks. And that's it. So just enough to get me through the next couple days.
Anything stand out to you price-wise in terms of things going up or going down?
Yeah, I think it was kind of split. I did see some stuff going up, like the fresh poke is a little bit higher than it's been, but I also found some good deals. So one of the things I really like is dried mandarins, and those are a little bit higher than I've seen them before. So just one bag, which is probably better for me because it's a lot of sugar. But yeah, I did make some choices today based on prices.
Have you noticed, say, over the last several months since the start of the new year, that you've made any changes to your shopping habits in general to deal with prices?
100%. I've been buying more in bulk and focusing more on getting grown food. So recently I went to 2 different farms and did a U-pick. So I was able to collect vegetables. I also started learning to can. So I canned, I want to say, like 40 jars of green beans recently. And I've never done that before in my life, but everything is getting more expensive and I'm on a fixed income, so I had to be a little bit more creative for me and my kids.
The winter of green beans, I like it. And you mentioned flying in. Are you visiting or do you go back and forth?
I do have family here, so I am just here for the weekend. And so this is to satiate my preferences. But yes, I do live on the mainland. I live in Northern California, just between Sacramento and Lake Tahoe.
How would you characterize the difference between sort of a shopping experience here at Foodland and a shopping experience back home in California?
That's a great question. I did find some better prices on the fresh fruit, which is not something you would normally expect since everything has to be flown in. But wherever it came from, I did get some better prices on nectarines than I've seen on the mainland. And I also got some Diageo pears. This was better pricing than I've seen at Costco on the mainland. So I did get those on impulse because they were great prices.
So Hawaii is famous for expensive food, but as you're saying, like if you do a little bit of navigating, you can find some stuff.
I would say that that's completely true, and I try to be price conscious across the board. So I'm not just running in with a blank check and saying I'm going to get whatever I want because I want it. I'm literally making at the moment decisions. I came in here for poke. I picked up a couple more things because the pricing was okay. I did get the poke because I wanted it, so I paid a little more for that. But everything else was pretty good. I was okay with the pricing.
Well, and it's half price, right, today?
Yes.
And how are you feeling about the economy in general?
It's frustrating. It's hard, especially when I look at food. I have 2 small children and myself, and eating plant-based and eating whole food is really critical. I have a serious medical condition, so I really have to steer away from processed food. And I mean, in one way, I'm blessed that I can make the choice, but in another way, it's pretty critical for my ongoing health. So I suffer with the cost of fresh, good food, processed food. You know, it's like that food desert type of thing where you end up with paying a lesser price for something that is a lesser quality because it can be processed in mass. So trying to navigate away from that, especially for my children too. So I always make sure our dinners have something fresh, whatever it is. And that has caused an increase in our prices. So we have, in the last 6 months, I would say, we have used food bank. We have shared groceries with friends. I've bought more rice than I've ever bought before as a supplement to try and boost kind of the fiber and the quantity of our meals, and just trying to round every corner. But it's a day-to-day, moment-to-moment. Every time I go shopping, it's on my brain. I don't feel like I can just go willy-nilly and be okay with the prices.
So much great stuff there you said. And I think your idea about communal shopping is a thing that really stands out to me. And also what you were just saying about trying to get fresh food at a price you can of four that's not processed food. That goes back to sort of the sweat equity and the elbow grease of like canning and going out to the farm.
That's 100% correct. And that's why I really wanted to put myself in a position to be slightly more uncomfortable, but to really be able to gain that win. When I went and did a U-Pick farm recently, I got 77 pounds of vegetables for $33. So that to me was a pretty significant win. Now, a lot of it had been gone through and I did have to do the labor of getting the green beans. I mean, they look just like the leaves and you're competing with the birds and you're competing with whether or not organic or any other type of fertilizers have been used. So are there more bugs? You know, what is the quality that you're looking at? So it's not something that's easy. I mean, that was 77 pounds curated over, I collected it in about 5 hours. So that's still also a lot of time. And when you consider the value of your time, let's say you pay yourself a McDonald's wage of $22 an hour, then I really kind of paid $133 or more, actually. So everything has a cost. You have to pay tax on something, either sweat equity or you're going to have to pay in the store.
We've been hearing from Jennifer, a frequent visitor from Northern California. She was talking to HVR's D.W. Gibson. We do want to hear from listeners on the neighbor islands about their grocery shopping experiences. What's in your cart? What have you noticed about prices these days? Leave a voicemail on our talkback line, 808-792-8217.
Support for HPR comes from Big Island Coffee Roasters' 15th anniversary celebration, online September 18th to 21st, featuring Kona Noir, Kau Yellow Bourbon, and more. BigIslandCoffeeRoasters.com/anniversary.
On the next Science Friday, digging in dust for the ancestry of asteroid Bennu.
What we're talking about here is, what were the baby photos like? Right? And now we're starting to piece together what's happened since then to sort of adulthood, which is where we are now.
Plus, sizing up the science of dietary supplements. That's on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
Support for HPR comes from Chaminade University, celebrating 70 years of educating tomorrow's leaders in social justice, healthcare, and organizational change. Learn more at chaminade.edu.
Extra, extra, read all about it. For today's Backyard Quiz, we asked you about student journalists. The Quill and Scroll is an international honor society that celebrates student achievement in journalism, and it was founded in 1926. Lots of recognizable names have been a part of the honor society, including the late film critic Roger Ebert and the actress Deborah Messing from the hit television show Will and Grace. Even Fred, or Mr. Rogers, got his start as a Quill and Scroll member. And at the time of its founding, there were just 19 original chapters, almost all of them in the Midwest. But just 2 years after the organization was founded, a Hawaii high school became a charter member as well. In fact, it is just one of 52 schools to hold a Quill and Scroll charter. Which Oahu school holds this distinction, we asked? Well, we were looking for McKinley High School. And congrats to Alice from Kahalanui. You got it right. Students there organized a chapter of the Honor Society way back in 1928. That's our quiz. If you have an idea to share, send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Today we shine the light on a transplant program that you may not be familiar with. Organ or bone marrow transplants are often in the news, but there have been great breakthroughs with stem cell and cord blood research that are less invasive procedures, but they still offer the gift of life. Today, we highlight a stem cell story. Mariel Tadena is a University of Hawaii student working toward a career in healthcare who signed up to be a donor. Nicole Fabella lives in California and whose blood disorder interrupted her degree in nursing. We talked to them this week, along with Erica Sevilla, a spokesperson for the National Marrow Donor Program, NMDP. Erica starts us off.
So every year, about 18,000 patients fighting blood cancers like leukemia and blood diseases like sickle cell disease will turn to a blood stem cell transplant or a bone marrow transplant for a potential cure or to treat their disease. And in order to have a blood stem cell transplant, you're going to need a donor who matches a genetic tissue type. So it's much more complicated than a blood donation, but it is a living donation, so similar to a plasma or platelet donation. And MVP manages the National Registry of Blood Stem Cell Donors in the United States, and more than 9 million people have swabbed their cheek, and they are typed and put on this national registry, and they wait for the call to potentially save a patient's life through blood stem cell transplant. So in this case, Marielle joined the registry, swabbed her cheek at the age of 18, which was incredible for somebody so young to be so mindful of the chance to impact somebody else's life. And just a few months after joining, she received a call to be a donor for an anonymous patient. When you're called to donate, it's anonymous, and you don't find out who your recipient of your blood stem cells is until a year or two later down the line. So it's really an incredible way for people to give hope to patients who are fighting blood cancers. You can join this national registry. You could potentially be called to save somebody's life. And if you get that call, donating is a lot easier than people realize. Again, it's a blood stem cell donation. Our body makes millions of blood stem cells every day. And so you can donate these cells to a patient, and they could effectively help cure their blood cancer.
And Mariel, you shared that you heard a story about a donor and a recipient, and it just touched your heart, and that's why you decided to sign up as a donor.
Yes, exactly that.
Share that story with our listeners.
So when I was in HOSA, so HOSA is a high school student organization that basically creates learning opportunities for students interested in careers in healthcare. So I competed in HOSA for about 4 years in high school, and my most interesting years was my junior and senior year. My junior year of high school, I was able to compete in the International Leadership Conference for HOSA, which was being held in Nashville. And I remember I was able to witness my first donor recipient meeting, and it was extremely powerful. So I remember I was only 17 at the time, but after seeing that, it really just stuck in the back of my mind, like, I'm going to do this at some point. And the following year, I got to compete in the ILC again, and this time I was 18, so I had kind of forgotten about it. And then just watching another donor recipient meeting, so my second one, it was really impactful because this time I really got to see what goes behind, like closed curtains kind of thing. So the recipient was a younger boy, and the donor was an adult female, and she had donated to him. And just hearing the story behind it, I remember just crying in my chair in the crowd, and, you know, like hearing his parents say, like, because she donated, he'll now go to high school, graduate, go to college, get married, have kids, and just that ripple effect, like, because someone did something for this person, you know, now they can live, you know, have that second chance at life.
And I understand too, Nicole, that Mariel was your third try, right? That you had other transplants before and they just didn't take?
Yes, that's correct. So my sister was my first donor in 2021, and my brother was my second donor in 2022, with Mariel being my third in 2023. And yeah, the first one just didn't take. The second one held for about 7 months, but Mariel's cells have been holding pretty strong.
Wow. And so do you recall, Mariel, when you met for the first time?
It was I've heard this a lot, when donors and recipients, you know, we always have that inexplicable bond even before we meet for the first time. So when I first met Nicole, it just felt like I already knew her. It was really funny. We have a funny story. For when we first met, we actually matched, like, in colors for our outfits.
Oh, my gosh.
And it was very unplanned. We were both wearing blue and white. And I remember when I first, so we were separated for the meeting. She was like in the green room on stage and I was out in the audience. And I remember the NMTP staff person, Maria, who is connecting us throughout our whole journey. She came back laughing, giggling to her seat where I was. And I was like, why are you laughing? And she was like, you guys are matching. So that was already like, I was so nervous at that time. So when she told me that, I was like, I already feel like I know Nicole. And it was another thing after that, we went to do like photos after our meeting. And we said the exact same sentence at the exact same time. And we were like, whoa, we had this joke. We're like, whenever we're together, the cells just like activate.
And, oh, that's yeah. great. And you know, Erica, I'm sure you've seen so many of these wonderful connections between donors and recipients over the years.
Yes. I mean, we help facilitate almost 8,000 transplants every year. And it's interesting because Nicole mentioned she did try to have a transplant with her siblings. There's a 25% chance that you'll find a match with your sibling, but the remaining 75% of patients will turn to NMDP to search the registry in the United States and then worldwide registries as well. And sometimes there are patients with no matching donors, no fully matched donors, and other times they can have several fully matched donors. And so a lot of it depends on your ethnicity and your genetic makeup. And I know that both Nicole and Marielle are of Asian descent, and typically Asian patients only have less than 50% chance of finding a fully matched donor on the registry. And that's just because of some underrepresentation. We need more diversity on the worldwide registries and on the NMDP registry. So in particular, you know, somewhere like Hawaii is very diverse, and you have a chance to have people from all backgrounds who can swab their teeth and join the registry. And so it's really valuable for people to just put themselves on the registry and see if they could be the match for somebody. It doesn't have to be today. It could be somebody who hasn't even been diagnosed yet with a blood cancer. And you might get a call. It could be a couple years down the line. And we just ask people to say yes to donating because it's a lot easier than people think.
And Mariel, I know, because you're Filipino, and I'm Filipino, and I know we chatted about this earlier, but there is sometimes a stigma that they do need more people who share Filipino heritage to sign up.
Yes, there is a stigma. I guess it's just we don't know a lot about what science is doing today. When I first heard that I was a match for Nicole, when I told my family, they weren't necessarily on board with it right away because they just didn't know. There was a lot of misconceptions, you know, like with bone marrow, you know, people think it's so invasive, but a lot of people don't know that there's the stem cell method too. So just donating through peripheral blood stem cells is one of the easier ways. It's just like donating plasma. And it's a way that, you know, people just need to be more aware of, or just we need to spread more awareness about so that we can get people on the registry and, you know, help more people of minority descent to find their matches. Because a lot of people are waiting for that match or waiting for potential donors when it should be the other way around, where us donors are waiting to be matched with them.
Oh, yeah. And Nicole, talk about what it means to you to know that on this third try, you know, you were a match.
I've always taken with the motto of third time's the charm, and it really just did happen to work in my favor in this way. But yeah, at the time when I was still waiting for a match, my family and I were feeling pretty down as far as our morale, having gone through with two full match siblings just for myself to relapse. And we were just really hoping that someone would open their heart to us and register and hopefully match for me. And science has come so far that Marielle and I were actually an 8 out of 10 match. And with how much science has progressed, a lot of people are able to successfully go through a stem cell transplant even with someone who is not a full match for them.
Well, you know, I know Muriel is in healthcare, and I understand that you're looking at nursing as well.
Yes, that's right. I was actually diagnosed in the middle of nursing school.
Wow, so this is really a chance to give back as well.
Absolutely.
Is there anything else that you want to share with our listeners just about this whole experience? I don't know, Muriel.
With this platform, I would like to encourage anyone, so any of the listeners listening right now, if you are from 18 to 40 years old, I really do recommend that you join the registry. It really is a good cause. You know, you could be that one person that could change the course of someone else's life. I like to think it in this perspective where you're not just changing one life, but you're also having that opportunity, just giving their family, their loved ones, their friends, just more time with this person, not having to say goodbye too early. So, you know, just being able to give a person another chance is a beautiful thing. And just being able to be kind to one another, like, it's one thing that I grew up with here in Hawaii, you know, just being kind, giving to one another. And even though it doesn't come back to you, you know you did a good thing. And yeah, that's what really matters.
It's aloha.
Yeah, it's aloha.
And Nicole, what about you?
I would have to just echo everything that Mariel has said. The impact that one person can make just by swabbing their cheek and potentially being a match for someone, their impact really is, it feels almost infinite. Because of Mariel, I get to continue on with my life and get to see more of the world and potentially impact the lives of others through nursing. And it's just a gift that I could not ever repay.
And Erica, any final thoughts?
I just think that people do not realize that inside of their bodies, we are producing stem cells that can be transplanted and engrafted into another person and give them a second chance at life. And that is such an amazing combination of science and love, as one transplant recipient has said. And I think it just shows the best of humanity and the best of science and how we can all give something of ourselves to help others. And for people who are over the age of 40, they're overqualified to join the registry. There are still other ways to support NMDP, whether through volunteering and hosting a drive or by making a financial donation so that you can provide a patient assistance grant for people going through transplant. That also helps a lot as well.
Well, I think, you know, the fact that you can give hope, right, and share hope is just a powerful thing. But thank you, all three of you, for carving out time for us today.
Thank you. Thank you, of course.
We've been hearing from NMDP spokeswoman Erica Sevilla, as well as stem cell recipient Nicole Fabella and donor Mariel Tadena, who are both working on careers in healthcare. Mahalo to them for sharing their story of aloha. For links to find out more, check out our website later today. Well, that's it for this Aloha Friday. Coming up next week, we talk about lessons learned by last month's tsunami scare. We do have a hurricane in our neck of the woods, so stay alert. Call our talkback line and share your experience from the tsunami. We do want to hear from you. 808-792-8217 or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can listen back to our shows on the conversation page of our website, hawaiipublicradio.org, and you can find the conversation as a podcast on Spotify or Apple. Our program is produced by Maddie Bender, Lillian Song, and D.W. Gibson, with support from Savannah Harriman-Pote and the HBR Digital Team. And we bid aloha to our SPJ Super Summers intern, Laura Dukes. Best to you. Backyard Quiz theme written for us by John DeMello. Our theme music courtesy of Gypsy 808. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us on Monday. Pick up the conversation.